we're evaluating our options. I mean, yeah, the discussion that we have with our legal team over the next day probably will result in a determination as to whether or not we appeal.
Joe Miller loses another round in court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska natives say they may fight confirmation of the new Fish and Game Commissioner.
We did that when previous governor appointed an attorney general that was not to our Alaska Native liking, and we were able to defeat that confirmation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Joe Miller's bid for an election contest has been turned down by a federal court. U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein this afternoon dismissed Miller's suit against the State Division of Elections, saying that the Republican candidate's latest amended complaint charging U.S. constitutional violations of state election laws cannot trump the Alaska Supreme Court's decision upholding voter intent. Beislein threw out Miller's complaint on both counts, that the Constitution's election clause, which put the manner of conducting elections squarely on the shoulders of the state legislature, and on the Equal Protection Clause, which requires specific standards on the part of elections officials. The judge said that the state election division's manner of counting write-in ballots complies with the Alaska Supreme Court's interpretation of the state statutory language. And Beislein said the determination of challenged ballots was made by one individual, the director of elections, giving a uniform standard to the count. We reached Joe Miller at his home minutes after the decision was released and asked him what's next.
One of the things that I picked out of the judge's order that I'm not finished reviewing yet is that he agrees that there are some things that need to be clarified by the legislature, and that may be, in fact, the proper step to go at this point, is to try to get some sort of statutory relief so that, you know, we aren't placed in the same circumstances that we faced this time around. But we're evaluating the decision, making a determination as to what we do next, if anything. And we'll certainly do that after consideration of all options.
Can you describe for me the concerns that you had about the violation of the Equal Protection Clause and the Elections Clause? Describe what you believe to be the proper interpretation of these clauses in the Constitution and how they were violated by this election.
No question that the way that the count progressed, and it's unfortunate that this really has not received, I think, good coverage in the press, is that the hand count resulted in additional ballots being included for the write-in candidate, whereas the machine candidates, those that were pre-printed on the ballot that received the machine count, didn't have the same benefit. The number was approximately 1,553 that was added in under the write-in candidate's tally. There's no opportunity for those that are pre-printed on the ballot to have a review of those ballots as the write-in candidates had to determine whether or not some of those unread ballots actually qualify. And again, in the case of the write-in candidate in this race, there were 1,553 approximately ballots that were added to the tally. Our position was, look, you can't approach a race and say that one candidate's ballots get a different review or receive, I guess, a higher value than another candidate's ballots.
Have you considered saying to the state, look, we want this recount, a hand recount of all of the ballots? Have you considered saying to the state, we'll pay for this, we want this done, proceeding that way?
Well, it looks like if we decide to do any type of recount, we have to pay for it anyway. Given the federal judge's decision, if we don't appeal it, we won't be within 0.5% that allows the state to fund the recount. But, you know, we had already said several weeks ago that we intended to pursue a recount with respect to a review by hand. And the state immediately, I think it was the director of the Division of Elections, said, hey, any recount's going to be by automated process. It's not going to be by hand. So already kind of undercut that approach. That is certainly worth discussion, and we would absolutely love to see the state come in and say, sure, hand count's fine. You pay for it as long as it's a reasonable cost. We'd probably pursue that. But I think that's unlikely given the statements that came out of the Division of Elections several weeks ago with regard to that issue.
I know that it was mentioned at one point that you were considering the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that still on the radar, given what happened today in Judge Beislein's court?
We're evaluating all our options. I mean, yeah, the discussion that we have with our legal team over the next day probably will result in a determination as to whether or not we appeal the federal judge's order. Of course, the sequence of appeals, Ninth Circuit, then U.S. Supreme Court. Also under state statute, you have a provision for a recount. You've got the provision as well for a what's called an election contest. So there are still, you know, other remedies that can be pursued. But, yeah, we're evaluating all options. We'll probably make a determination here in the next several days and of course, notify the people of the state of Alaska as to what we decide to do at this point.
How hard has this been for you personally to continue this fight financially, emotionally? What's this process been like for you?
It has been financially challenging for us because even though the FEC permitted us during the campaign to draw a salary from campaign funds, we chose not to do that. In fact, we've not received any salary, any financial benefit from the race or from the subsequent legal events that have occurred after the election. And because of where we're at, obviously, I've not started up my private practice again, my law firm. It has been obviously fiscally challenging, but we've done this because we believe it's the right thing to do. And we remain committed, you know, to that concept that, look, we believe that ballots ought to be treated the same. We believe that there really does need to be full transparency in the elections process. We don't have that now. And I think that there certainly are some significant changes that can be made, you know, perhaps through legislative action to help correct some of these things. So it's worth the cost because it's the right fight.
And what about the future? Has this experience soured you on the political process? Do you see yourself running for office again?
Don't have any plans, any specific plans whatsoever to run for office. No, I'm not soured. I mean, I'm a realist. I recognize that a reformer is always going to face opposition, significant opposition. And, you know, I recognize that clear back in the primary. I mean, this has always been a David and Goliath type approach.
A spokeswoman for the Division of Elections says election officials are reviewing the judge's decision and are withholding comment at this time. Meanwhile, the state of Alaska plans to seek nearly $16,000 in legal fees from Joe Miller's team over litigation surrounding the U.S. Senate race. The Department of Law says its attorney fees related to Miller's challenge in state superior court totaled more than $79,000. The department says it's allowed to recover 20% of the fees and is seeking just under $16,000. A link to the entire Joe Miller interview is at our website, aprn.org. Cora Campbell's appointment as Fish and Game Commissioner for the state continues to raise objections from Native organizations. The Southeast-based Alaska Native Brotherhood says it may try to block her confirmation by the legislature. But both sides also say they're willing to talk. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports from Juneau.
The Alaska Native Brotherhood's regional leadership came out swinging when it learned Governor Sean Parnell was about to name Cora Campbell Fish and Game Commissioner.
We are not afraid of going to the legislature and expressing our views.
Longtime Southeast Tlingit activist Bob Loescher heads up the ANB's Subsistence Committee.
We did that when previous governor appointed an attorney general that was not to our Alaska Native liking, and we were able to defeat that confirmation.
The governor appointed Campbell to head the department just before Christmas. The 31-year-old former commercial fisherman used to head up the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association. She more recently worked as fisheries advisor to former Governor Sarah Palin, and she handled similar duties as a special assistant to Parnell. Loescher says his group doesn't know her, and it should.
We're very concerned going forward that her inexperience and her lack of knowledge of who the players are throughout Alaska outside of the commercial fisheries arena could be hindering her role in the fish and game management as we look forward to 2011.
He says ANB worries fish and game is already biased towards commercial fisheries and against subsistence, and the new commissioner will be more so. Campbell says she's heard that before, and it's wrong.
Many people associate me with the commercial fishing industry because that's where I spent my early years. But the fact of the matter is I transitioned into a different role several years ago, a statewide role with responsibilities to a broad constituency and to all user groups.
Campbell says her time in the governor's office gave her a chance to learn about a wide range of fish and game issues, and she says she's closely followed subsistence.
One of my jobs prior to going to work for the state was to supervise an education and outreach program, and that program was aimed at increasing awareness of the dual federal and state management systems and to promote public involvement in the subsistence management process.
Campbell says she's already talking to the ANB about meeting to address its concerns. She says she hopes leaders come to see her as a partner rather than an opponent.
I particularly just want to assure them that I have a deep concern and respect for the subsistence lifestyle and the subsistence issues that they deal with, and that I want to have a close working relationship with them going forward.
ANB's Loescher says he's interested in a meeting, but if his group isn't satisfied, it won't be alone.
Alaska Native Brotherhood is just part of many, many groups across the state focused on making sure that assistance resource be granted to as a preference and a priority to the Alaska Natives and rural community people.
The other commissioner finalist was Board of Game member Ron Somerville. ANB leaders say that was a slap in their face since the 73-year-old Juneau resident had been a longtime foe of their subsistence goals. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough is in need of a borough manager. After narrowing down a field of dozens of applicants to only three, the Borough Assembly has decided to hire a national executive search firm from Florida. Colin Basinger and Associates will continue the process of locating and hiring a borough manager. Patty Sullivan, borough spokeswoman, says the Assembly met this week to discuss the matter. Assembly members shared what qualities they're looking for in a new manager and asked how the search firm can promote the borough. Currently, representatives of the company are touring the Matanuska Valley's points of interest. The successful manager applicant will replace former borough manager John Duffy, who resigned in June of this year. Matsu voters will head to the polls to elect a new borough mayor in a special election on January 11th. Eight mayoral candidates have thrown their hats into the ring. The election winner will fill a partial borough mayor term, which ends in October of 2012. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, getting tough on truancy.
And he came up with this idea of going directly to filing paperwork through the troopers that can ticket the parents.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals, online at neaalaska.org.
The massive project to bring true broadband internet coverage to the Bristol Bay region by 2013 got a big boost recently with the selection of a group of contractors. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
GCI's wholly owned subsidiary, United Utilities, announced Monday that Marsh Creek LLC has been chosen as the prime contractor to construct 11 microwave communication sites as part of GCI's Terra Southwest project. Those sites include four mountaintop microwave towers and seven towers in villages in the Bristol Bay region. Marsh Creek is a Small Business Administration 8A company based in Anchorage and is jointly owned by the Kaktovik and Nupiat Corporation and the Anchorage-based company Solston XP. John Ely is the chief operating officer for Marsh Creek, and he confirms the company specializes in remote construction projects.
The remote site construction in Alaska is probably our greatest area of revenue, and it's certainly one of our specialty areas. We're very good at going to places that are hard to get to and doing projects that are hard to accomplish.
He confirmed that work is already underway to get ready for 2011.
We are staging to start our construction operations this spring, and we are hoping to have our portion of construction completed
by the fall. Obviously, there are a lot of moving pieces in a project like this, and permitting's one of them.
The other key contractors on the Terra Southwest project include HECO Services and Southwest Alaska Contractors. Craig Johnson is the Director of Rural Broadband Development for GCI, and he says it was important that the lead contractor and the other contractors that will do the work on the project had ties to the state of Alaska.
We feel like we've selected a team of Alaskan-based contractors that really have good experience in Alaska. The local hire is very important to us.
Much of the Terra Southwest project will be located on land controlled by the federal government, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is currently preparing an environmental assessment. Johnson anticipates the environmental assessment to be completed in the first few months of next year.
We are right now working with the agencies to schedule some meetings in February out in Dillingham and Togiak and Good News Bay, making sure that we're taking into account all of the environmental effects of the project and doing it right.
The preparation of the environmental assessment is not expected to delay the first part of the project slated for actual construction, which is the laying of fiber optic line from Igiagic to Leavelock. Construction of that part of the project is scheduled to begin next month. Another aspect of the large Terra Southwest project includes an upgrade to the existing DeltaNet regional microwave network in the YK Delta region. The part of the project that will run through the Bristol Bay region will feature microwave and fiber optic technology to serve 22 communities in the region. Those two parts of the project will then connect to the existing broadband network on the Kenai Peninsula and in the Anchorage area through a fiber optic line that will run beneath Cook Inlet. The Terra Southwest project is funded by $88 million in loans and grants that came to GCI through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The current plan is to have the entire Terra Southwest project up and running by 2013. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Educators in the Bethel region have been using truancy laws to coax students and parents into ensuring kids get to school. And Northwest Alaska educators are also taking a hard look at school truancy rates and are joining with parents and law enforcement to try to boost school attendance. KOTZ's Susan Bucknell has the story.
Some schools in Western Alaska with a common problem of truancy work together on ways to get kids back in the classroom. Northwest Arctic Borough School District Superintendent Dr. Norman Eck shares some history on finding a solution.
Last year, we were very worried about many students who just aren't attending school regularly. Kids from 7 through 16 have to attend school. This is law, but there was no enforcement of it.
It wasn't for lack of trying.
We would go to the troopers and say, we'll take it to the district attorney. We'd go to the district attorney and they'd say, we're too busy. We're dealing with all these other issues that are life and death issues.
Dr. Eck said that several superintendents requested help from the state.
We went to Governor Parnell and he pulled together the Commissioner of Education, the Commissioner of Labor, the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, the Commissioner of Public Safety, the Attorney General. There were six of us superintendents, and we met with them and said, we need help. We have to help these children be able to be in school on a regular basis.
At that time, the Attorney General was Dan Sullivan.
And he came up with this idea of going directly to filing paperwork through the troopers that can ticket the parents.
Eck is convinced that staying in school is essential to the well-being of the student.
All research across the United States shows that unless you have an attendance rate in a school of 95% or better, it's very unusual for that school to be able to do well. Our average attendance in our district is down around 88%.
Eck found willing partners in this approach to curbing chronic truancy.
The school board approached my school resource officer and asked if there was something that could be done about the truancy issue.
It's Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Stone of Kotzebue.
And I told him, yes, we have state statute that covers that.
Stone said if they have personnel available,
we can take some action in that direction, and we can also get our VPSOs on board to help do some of that.
Stone said statistics show that children who don't attend school end up dealing with law enforcement more often than kids who do go to school.
Well, not to get parents into the courthouse. What this is to do is to get kids back into those classrooms. So once the parents are notified of it, they have an obligation to get them there.
Stone said there haven't been very many truancy violations written by the troopers.
There's only been a handful of them. I don't expect that to increase a whole lot. I think once people see that there is a penalty for it, that they're going to adhere to it.
Stone said they're really trying to solicit cooperation to get kids back in school. Michelle Woods is the attendance counselor for Northwest Arctic Borough School District.
And the way that I get involved is that after 4 unexcused daily absences, I will send a letter to the parent notifying them that their student is in violation of the policy. And also in that letter, I'll notify them of some of the local resources that are available to them and also make myself available.
Wood said they emphasize they want the parents speaking with the teacher and the principal about the attendance and about how the child is doing in school.
Then at 8 absences, I'll send them another letter. This one requires that the parent come to the school and meet with the principal to talk about the attendance issue. And at 11 daily unexcused absences, then I'll send them another letter, and this is the last letter they'll receive from me, where they are discussing an alternative education plan.
Woods said that excused absences include illness or medical appointments or a death in the immediate family, and that seasonal subsistence activities can be excused absences.
So those are our excused absences. At 20, unexcused absence is when I go to the superintendent and ask to charge the parents.
The first level is a violation, similar to a traffic citation. Hopefully that's all that's needed to improve attendance. John Earthman, state district attorney in Nome, said he prefers that if a serious chronic truancy problem requires more action beyond the violation, the next step should be to involve the State Office of Children's Services. As a final step, parents can be charged with a misdemeanor, which is a criminal charge. The charge would be contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Northwest Arctic's Dr. Eck emphasized that kids really need their education.
We don't want anything that's going to be harmful to anyone, but we want to make people understand you have to go to school.
Schools, parents, and the justice system in Western Alaska are trying to find ways to keep students in school and learning. For KOTZ News, this is Susan Bucknell.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Another Canadian mining company has announced plans to explore for gold and copper in the Bristol Bay area next year. Vancouver-based Millrock Resources has staked more than 266 claims, covering more than 66 square miles of land, about 50 miles northeast of Dillingham. Millrock named the site Humble Property and says the geological, geochemical, and geophysical characteristics there are similar to those believed to exist at the Pebble deposit. Millrock has planned a limited drilling program for 2011, which will be funded primarily by a subsidiary of Kinross, a large multinational mining corporation. Kinross is currently operating the Fort Knox mine in Alaska and has other operations in Washington State, as well as Chile, Russia, Canada, and Brazil. Millrock Resources currently has 12 active exploration projects, including 9 gold and copper properties in Alaska and 3 copper prospects in Arizona. Scientists will conduct field experiments on juvenile red king crab this summer in southeast Alaska. It's all part of a larger study that could someday lead to a king crab hatchery program. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein spoke with one of the lead researchers and has this report.
The multi-year project was prompted by concern over depleted crab stocks around Kodiak and the Pribilof Islands. Ginny Eckert is associate professor of fisheries for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's based in the School for Fisheries and Ocean Sciences in Juneau.
The hatchery project started in 2006. It was sort of a community-based sort of ground movement that there were people that were concerned that king crabs have declined and haven't recovered even in the absence of fishing. And so there are individuals that wanted to see if we could culture king crabs on a large scale.
So a coalition of scientists, fishermen, fishery businesses, and Alaska Native groups form the Alaska King Crab Research, Rehabilitation, and Biology Program. Eckert is one of the lead researchers who's raised larval crab to their first juvenile stage at the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery in Seward. Eckert says 2007 was their first culture year.
And we didn't have very good success that year. In subsequent years, we've done quite well. In 2009 and 10, we were able to produce over 100,000 juvenile red king crab in both years.
This summer, they'll be conducting more field research on how juvenile crab deal with predation in the wild. The work will take place in Yankee Cove near Juneau. Like in the Pribilofs, fishery managers in southeast Alaska have also closed red crab fishing for several years because of stock concerns. Eckert says one potential explanation for why depleted king crab stocks haven't recovered is that too many of the tiny juvenile crab are being eaten by predators.
A couple of years ago, we initiated a field project with cameras that we mounted underwater to record what predators came along and ate king crabs that were tethered. And the project went very well. It was logistically pretty challenging, but it went pretty well. So we'll be doing a follow-up to that to learn more about predation in the wild of these very small king crabs. These king crabs we'll be using will be on the order of 5 to 10 millimeters.
That's about the size of a pen cap or a small button. The researchers actually use a piece of monofilament to tie the crab in front of the camera. In previous studies, they found sculpin were the main predator. Eckert says they've been looking at things like the way habitat or the lack of habitat affects predation. They've also looked at the difference age makes on predation, how vulnerable a crab is that just hatched that year versus a crab that hatched the year before. Meanwhile, researchers are also studying whether hatchery-reared red crabs can actually be conditioned to life in the wild by exposing them to predators in the lab.
When you expose these small crabs to fish in a non-lethal way and then later expose them to fish again, they have an increased survival rate.
Eckert believes there is a potential for hatchery enhancement of wild red king crab stocks, but at this point, the researchers still have a lot more work to do.
One of the important parts will be trying to figure out where are there bottlenecks in the life history of these crabs. If, in fact, the bottleneck is at the juvenile stage, then if we add more juveniles, that could then ultimately produce more adults for basically people to eat.
So Eckert says it would be a while before any large-scale enhancement could happen. The AK Crab program has received over $300,000 in grant money from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and nearly $160,000 of in-kind and support services from the Aleutic Pride Hatchery, Alaska Fish and Game, the University, and Alaska Sea Grant. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Mike Mason and Adam Kane in Dillingham, Susan Bucknell in Kotzebue, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.